Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
This episode is brought to you by Body Armor Zero Sugar. The brand new Zero Sugar sports drink from our friends at Body Armor provides real hydration with no artificial sweeteners, flavors, or dyes. And whether you're looking to stay hydrated or recovering from a long weekend, Body Armor Zero Sugar has got you covered. With great tasting flavors like Fruit Punch and Lemon Lime. Available in stores nationwide, head on over to Body Armor Store on Amazon and get yours today.
It's a Tuesday edition here on Zero Block 30, and today we have five rounds in the magazine. Round number one, we're going to do a little New Zealand goofing. Our Kiwi pals announced that they haven't had any new cases of COVID-19 in 44 days. The part that blew me away is that they acted like they've been there before and handed the ball off to the referee. That's not what I would do if I was the leader of a nation. I would be fucking doing all kinds of celebration dances right in everybody's faces. Round number two, President Trump is taking shots at my guy Colin Powell and his legacy over the remarks that the general and former Secretary of State gave on CNN this weekend. We're going to get into that just a tiny, tiny little bit. Round number three, the Marine Corps has banned all Confederacy-related images and flags from their bases. We asked the baby girls, who, that's you, the baby girls
Hi,
are
baby
the listeners,
girls.
Be banned next? And the answers didn't disappoint as always. Round number four, this one, as I've been waiting, I was talking about it on the rundown last week. I'm super excited for you guys to hear this one because an attorney joins the show to talk about his job, but it's not litigation. He joins to talk about the 1,600 hours he spent as an Air Forward Observer where he earned, hold on to your asses, four Distinguished Flying Crosses, one Bronze Star, a Purple Heart, and an Air Medal with Combat V in one deployment. Jim Dunn joins the show to talk about his combat experiences, which include getting shot with not an AK, not something small, not a 5.56, not like a M4 or anything like that. He got shot with a motherfucking machine gun through the foot, and he talks about it. Before we get going with the story, it's so crazy, just a spoiler alert, he never mentions and talks to his kids about the fact that he was shot with a machine gun.
I mean, I think you would have to lead with that as a dad. Just whenever your kids get unruly, like, remember, I got shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whenever my kid a couple weeks ago, I think I told a story on this show, might have been on a different show, but I talked about how Kelsey fell off her bike and came and when she was acting like she was in a lot of pain, I was like, on a scale of one to dad got shot, how bad does it hurt?
Yeah.
And I would make
perfect card there.
I mean, my goodness, this guy didn't even mention getting shot by a machine gun through a foot where he said it could see like through the foot. Insane story. You're going to love that one. Round number five, you can only wear one uniform item for the rest of your life. One uniform. One, it has to be a full considered a uniform. You can only wear that. And that's what you're wearing all the time, 24/7 for the rest of your life. I'm going to ask both of you which uniform that should be. You cannot choose PT gear.
No!
Letting that go right away because I already saw Kate going green on green with the sweats.
Exactly. That is exactly what I'm saying. Tenny runners.
Mm-hmm. I knew that was it. Tenny runners and green on green sweats.
Yep.
That is super comfortable, but you can't do that. And all that today is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Romans. I want you guys, you can't see it because this is an audio show, but just in case we have a social media clip, I want you guys to look deep in my eyes. What do you notice?
I don't know.
We're blue? I don't know.
No, there's no banana-induced pink eye right now.
Yeah, that's true.
And my skin is looking better. I've actually been using this stuff from Roman, and it is awesome.
Your skin does look good today. Remember when we first logged on, I asked you, I'm like, you do something different? You're glowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My skin is looking a little better because of the Roman stuff. They sent it. I actually got on and got the free consultation and all that. It actually is working, and I'm noticing that my eyes aren't as – I'm not getting banana-induced pink eye nearly as much, which is super nice. You need skincare that actually performs, and getting started can be overwhelming. It really can be. If you've never done – like going to a dermatologist, that's the last level on the things that most people care about is going to a skin doctor, especially right now. When you're in quarantine, you're not going out, you're not going to the dentist, you're sure as shit not going to the dermatologist. You don't have to go anywhere. You can upload your photos. They'll send them to you. It's free skincare treatment with 2 free-day shipping, and you can also get unlimited follow-ups with your doctor, which you can't do anywhere else if you need to make a treatment or you have questions. With Roman, there's no commitments, and you can cancel anytime. Go to GetRoman.com/Barstool Offer for a free online visit to start your new skincare routine today. That's GetRoman.com/Barstool Offer. eligibility restrictions and additional terms may apply. They're going to get back to you in 24 hours, which is incredible, the things that they're doing. Roman, it's not just for boners, folks. That's what that would be my tagline.
If I Roman, said. Not just for boners.
But if you need some boner help,
they got you. They do got tummy you on sticks. That, too.
Khan's on the radio show today. I had to explain what tummy sticks was to Kate.
I didn't. Oh. I'd heard of them.
I've never heard of it?
I'd heard of them, but I didn't know what it was. Mm. So now I know.
How'd you feel about it now that you know?
I still don't quite understand, but that's okay. I say,
I kind of explained it like pick 'em up sticks with dicks.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's basically it, I guess.
Okay.
Like right. Jenga. Mixing them together like Jenga.
Okay.
Pull one out, see what happens. Let's get started with the show. Kate, you were out in town doing a little protesting, going out there with the Black Lives Matter group, getting your voice heard, seeing people in Brooklyn all across. I bet there's moments that, because I know you so well, that you're introspective Katie a lot. I bet there are certain parts where you just sat back and you just thought, this is a delight. So many people are out here. This is just a delight.
It really, and just talking to like meeting your neighbors and people in your community and just like learning from other people. And I was telling Chaps, there was this little van called the People's Bodega that was stopping a few blocks ahead of the march over and over. And it was just like a free snacks and water and drinks. They had people going around sunscreen in the white people's arms. So it was just funny. It was really, yeah, it was an awesome experience. It's pretty cool. That's democracy.
I have big time sunscreen, Dad, around my house. I have some right here. Two bottles right here. I'll grab it.
Oh, yeah.
in his studio, which, by the way, is inside.
Inside.
Inside. I have two right here because if one of my kids is going outside, I'm like, ah.
Come over here.
Dad's office. I need to spray you down with a little bit of sunscreen before you go out. I'm big time sunscreen dad, so I appreciate that. You know who's not sunscreen mom?
Who?
Mary Beth that works at Barstool. Whenever we did that devour event.
Yeah, she got mad.
So Mary Beth, she works in the sales side, and we always like lean on her. If we go on a trip and Mary Beth is there, you know everything is going to be taken care of.
We treat her like a mom a lot, and she's not. She's,
yep.
But she's not her job.
She's the one that has like the company credit card and things like that. So if we're going out to eat, she picks up the tab. She does all that stuff. We're so used to that a couple years ago, about 2 years ago now, we went out to this park in Brooklyn, or I think it was in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And we were playing this game, and everybody just goes up to Mary Beth, a couple people, like four or five of us, like, hey, MB, you got any sunscreen? And she finally had enough. And she looked at like me and Big Cat PFT, and she was like, I'm not your fucking mom. Your own sunscreen.
Leave me alone.
That's fair.
She reached her breaking point, which is understandable.
Yeah.
MB, do you have any? Fun. Mary Beth, do you have any gummy snacks or sunscreen or whatever?
You have a Capri Sun in your purse or anything?
Say, Andy, you got any juice boxes?
Yeah.
I would love a juice box. I actually told my wife, because we've been having, I don't know if I mentioned it here or not, we had this snack jug on my front porch that any of the neighborhood kids can come by and get any of the snacks that they want. I told her we should get one of those huge packs of like 50. Do you remember those little barrels that were like green and blue and red?
Oh,
and we could just have those out in the yard and be like, just get whatever you want, kiddos.
Those are pure sugar, dude. Those are called Huggies. We still get them down the shore every year. Huggies. Yeah, we get them down the shore. They're like straight sugar. They're so good. Yeah. Put a little booze in them. Tell you what.
Yeah, I had a straight sugar snack last night too. Posted it on Twitter. Wifey made from scratch Nestle Toulouse. Cookies, little Nestle Tollhouse cookies. I ate 5 chocolate chip cookies and a huge glass of orange juice, and it was
the weirdest thing about you.
No, but
you didn't know that, Kate. That's like his go-to move. He does orange juice to cut the sweetness of the chocolate chips.
Oh God, that's upsetting.
It's by far the weirdest, most disgusting thing that Chaps does.
Huh. Yeah, anytime I have something that's super sweet, I want something very acidic to like cut through it, and that's what orange juice or ruby red does. It like cuts that, because otherwise you just have chocolate throat forever.
So that was
your weekend. Cons, I was concerned about you. I was going to say something, but I didn't feel like a public rebuking was quite necessary, but you were getting close.
Do it.
I'm scared.
Rebuke
Why?
Him.
The lack of social distancing between you and Lurch from 4Play Podcast was concerning. I was like, this guy, not setting the example. All the troops are watching. All the baby girls are on Instagram seeing this. The baby girls are going to be putting themselves and be like, well, Skipper did it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I honestly, I'd have no rebuke. I'll take full ownership there. There was just so much emotion
being shared during the round of golf that we played yesterday with our two other buddies. And it was just, my weekend was really back to what a normal summer weekend looks like for me typically. And it was just so refreshing to get on the train Friday to go down to the shore, had dinner down the shore with my family. And then Saturday morning, a nice long, I like going on a really long bike ride on Saturday morning, because then everything else you do the rest of that day on Saturday, you don't feel necessarily as guilty.
You can
about.
Be a so real piece of shit after a long bike ride. Yep.
Right.
I get it.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we went like 12 or 13 miles, just along the shoreline. Along
how
the
long
beaches.
Did you go a couple weeks ago, Kate?
35. Oh, mind wow. you. So you only went how many cons?
Only 13. Sorry.
Oh, that's cute though.
Yeah. but that's what's great about a bike though. You blink and then all of a sudden you're like 20 miles in. It doesn't even feel it.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting to see some of the towns down the shore. You would not know there was a pandemic that we were coming off the heels of. There were a lot of people out and about, social distancing, I suppose, but I just saw a lot of people. It looked like a very normal
day. In halftime of coronavirus. We're about to get hit with a big old spike. That's just what's going to happen.
Well, I mean, and then as I mentioned, I played golf yesterday, which was fantastic, even though we lost our match. But what do you guys think? So we've seen these protests, and I think they're fantastic. But it's like Corona just ceased to exist. No mention of Corona.
Well,
a lot of people wearing the masks, but they have been very much closer than 6 feet to one another.
I think the answer to that, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did this wonderful op-ed where he said that there's other systematic things in play that are killing Black Americans at a far higher pace than COVID-19 and the Black community. And sorry, I've been getting this question. A lot of people were chirping that at me. The Black community, they were the first to lose their jobs, some of the most to lose their jobs, and the highest death rate comparatively. So they understand it's affecting them the most, but this is so important that it is more important than that. And two, seeing doctors and nurses.
It's like a military term, right? Like
supporting them here. Yeah.
You have ORM. You have like your operational risk management. Like, you know that at certain points you are going to be accepting risk. When is that risk acceptable, right?
Yeah. And so because of the things that happened, it became.
Man, what a military tie-in.
It became more important. And but like two, even at the protests I was at, the very first thing they do when you get there is make sure you have a mask. And if you don't, they're handing them out. And like, even when we did
silver bullets too, weren't they doing that?
They did have road guards. But yeah, definitely. And too, I'm getting so many people chirping, well, I guess they don't care about COVID. And I'm like, are you also going around and commenting that on all your favorite bars Instagrams with all the white kids on the patios like crammed together? Like, no, you're not. So like, no, I'm not saying that to you, cons, but I know that.
No, cons, but give it to them, Kate.
Yeah. I've just been hearing it a lot.
Leave Kate alone, cons.
I think it's interesting too, just because where Kate, you and I are in the country, it's just such a heightened concern. You go to other parts of the country and
it's nothing.
Yeah, they've pretty much gotten past it essentially. Yep. And their bars are open and people are out there and living their lives. So it's just interesting to see.
You're right.
And
no,
I had my first experience like going to a hospital or anything like that really since all this stuff started. I had to go on Friday. I went to the neurologist. I've been having, and I'm pretty open about like my health stuff here because I have traumatic brain injury. Occasionally things pop up that make me like scared or nervous about like what my future is going to look like. Lately, I've been having handshakes, like where where my right hand shakes all the time, kind of like Parkinson's style. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the doctor to get that checked out. I had a 15-minute long conversation with a salesman the other day. He called me back later in that afternoon, didn't remember the conversation at all.
Yeah.
And so it was something that I just wanted to go get checked out. Mm-hmm. Well, after I was done, that kind of stuff is always super depressing because you realize what the future might entail for you. Like if I, like Parkinson's would be something that's terrible if I struggled with that, if I was constantly having like arm shakes and dealing with everything that comes along with Parkinson's, and then long-term memory loss would be fucking horrible. That's not something I
so
want
you
for
got
myself.
It. What they said.
Right. So that they just basically said they're going to give me some more like treatment options, gave me some things that I could do, but they just essentially said like, yeah, this is your life. Like, this is what you're going to have to deal with. It's going to be part of your life moving forward. And you just have to do things to mitigate some of those risks. So after I was done with that, I went to Home Depot just to kind of clear my head and walk around because I'm a tool guy.
Where dudes go to clear their heads. Yeah.
So Feidelberg called me because he had this idea that he wanted to pitch to me content wise to see if I wanted to help out on it. And he was like, what are you doing? And I said, I'm just in Home Depot. And he's like, well, what are you buying? And I was like, I'm not sure. I'm just kind of like fucking around here, just seeing what's going on. What's going on with the fellas. And it is kind of nice to come home and have that hobby. Like, and that's what I did this weekend, going through, spent an inordinate, the truck slush fund is no more. I've cut myself off. No more tools, things like that. But Gus got his bed. I posted that video. If you haven't checked it out, go to BarstoolSports.com or YouTube page at ZeroBlack30 podcast. It's on there too. Gus loves it. And every time, you know, there's certain things in your life where every time you see it, it makes you happy. Gus being curled up, because he has two big beds, one from Costco, one is called a stress pillow that I got him. And it sits right in his new little bed. And he has flattened it because he weighs almost 100 points. Pounds, where it's like a nest, and he gets into it and he just cuddles up and he looks so fucking cute. And every time I walk into our master bedroom, I'm like, there's my guy. This there is the best thing I've ever built. So worth it.
Love it.
That's fantastic. Also, Home Depot, great smell in Home Depot.
I agree.
I agree too. Yeah, it is a great smell. Somebody actually said that because I said I wanted to have some random topics. What is something that as soon as you smell it, you know where you are? If I put a blindfold on you and you walked in, where would you know you are with a blindfold?
Wawa.
Come on, Katie. Wawa.
Immediately.
Also, down the shore, that salt in the air.
Yep, down the shore, but Wawa for sure, hands down. This is the smell of the coffee island has soaked into everything in the store. Into every single one of them, and you know as soon as you walk in, it's delightful.
Number one for me, I have two that really stick out. Number one, I'll always know if I'm in a thrift store. They all smell exactly the same.
Yeah.
And libraries smell the same too.
That's true. A Ross Dress for Less. You know what that... I saw a picture of... It was a Ross Dress for Less that had been looted, but the joke was that you couldn't tell if it had been or not because they're always such a fucking mess.
Have you ever gone to a Ross like after Black Friday or after a huge sale?
People just throw clothes everywhere. Yes, I'm one of them. I'm like, fuck it. Everybody else is. I like to toss all this shit around. Anyway, cool.
All right, let's get into the actual topics of the day. The first one is coronavirus related. It comes to us from New Zealand because their prime minister, who seemingly is doing an awesome job in basically everything that she touches, her name is Jacinda Ardern, and she is the head of the parliament there in New Zealand, made a bunch of tough decisions. It was really looked at worldwide, and people were surprised that New Zealand went to such lengths right away. They shut every fucking thing down. Like, as soon as the first case in New Zealand happened, they were like, nope, we are done. They shut down everything. Now they haven't had any cases in 44 days. Here she is talking about that experience and how she also was dancing with her kid after they found out that there had been no new cases, that nobody in New Zealand had coronavirus. Here she is.
Today, there are no active cases in New Zealand. We have tested almost 40,000 people for COVID-19 in the past 17 days, and none have tested positive. We have had no one in hospital for COVID-19 for 12 days. It's been 40 days since the last case of community transmission, 22 days since that person finished their self-isolation. And so today, I can announce that Cabinet has agreed we will now move to level one to get our economy fully open again, and we will start almost immediately. We move down to COVID-19 alert level one from midnight tonight. We are confident we have eliminated transmission of the virus in New Zealand for now. But elimination is not a point in time. It is a sustained effort. We almost certainly will see cases here again. And I do want to say that again. We will almost certainly see cases here again. And that is not a sign that we have failed. It is a reality of this virus. But if and when that occurs, we have to make sure, and we are, that we are prepared. That's the reason our borders remain our first line of defence, as we aim not to import the virus.
Any reactions when you heard there were no active cases of COVID-19 remaining in New Zealand?
I did a little dance. Definitely not. I showed Neve. She was caught a little by surprise, but she joined in, having absolutely no idea why I was dancing around the lounge, but enjoying it nonetheless.
She handled that with much more class than I would, because everybody's like, oh, look at little New Zealand. New Zealand's doing this. I would be like, in your motherfucking face. Science, bitch. I'm a scientist, bitch.
She also, there's a video just from a couple weeks ago. She was doing a press conference when, and it was a live one, when an earthquake started. And I mean, that's a big deal in New Zealand. Remember the Christchurch one and everything. Mm-hmm. But so it starts shaking and she stayed calm and collected and kept talking to everybody through it. Well, it appears we're having a bit of an earthquake here, but that's okay. It'll be over in a minute there. All right. And she just was like so fucking chill.
This and makes obviously the accent just adds so much to it when she's, you know, with all that decorum up on the podium and then to have the accent on top of it.
People from New Zealand are my favorite, man. I watched this show about a morgue in New Zealand where this guy works.
Of course you do.
And he is, it's a family morgue and he's probably my age and he has a family and things like that. And so whenever they came in to the morgue, he was like, oh, Mr. Johnson, we're sorry that you've gone to the other side. You look beautiful in your suit. And he talks to like the dead bodies and he's just such a gentle creature.
Yeah.
He's like, oh yes, we'll go to the other side together. We'll make sure you look absolutely beautiful.
Like, I want my body to go to that guy. Please, I know, me too. Send me over
and
there.
He'll be in there. He takes it so seriously. Cause you think of, I mean, let's be honest. Most people who are morticians are fucking weirdos. Like,
well,
you don't get into the undertaking game.
The army strapped a dead lady into a vehicle and blew it up. So rest in peace, Doris. Remember that
one? Most morticians are
Doris.
Weird. And you think of like the Dexter character in Six Feet Under and the Undertaker from WWE and Paul Bearer. Like, that's who I think of when I think of different type of morticians. This guy bust out his ukulele. He'll sing some songs to the dead bodies and like, we'll just usher you over to the other side. Yeah,
just a peaceful fella. Flight of the Conchords too. Another awesome show that I loved.
Hilarious, yeah.
Murray, the booked you guys a gig. And then they go, it's in a park in Newark, New Jersey. And they're like, what the hell? And he said, I said, a Central Park in Newark. They were thinking they booked a gig in Central Park in New York. Like, that is such a great show. Oh, New Zealand. Yeah.
Also great Undertaker, mortician in recent memory that I just watched was My Girl, Dan Aykroyd.
He was
a delightful mortician.
Oh, yeah.
Also from Flight of the Conchords, they sang the song that was the crab song in Moana.
Hell yeah.
I'm shiny.
Hell yeah. All right. New Zealand.
All right, that's New Zealand talk here on the podcast. Good for them. I would be spiking the ball all over the place, but good for New Zealand. They're doing the damn thing over there. Strong leadership from their prime minister. Love to see that. Let's move on to round number two. This one's going to be a quick round because president was taking shots at Colin Powell again. Now, this is 2 weeks in a row. Now, I've kind of cooled my jets a little bit about Mattis, but Colin Powell is my favorite military person of all time. Mm-hmm. I love Colin Powell. I think he is wise beyond measure. He said something in his interview that he did with Jake Tapper where he was talking about President Trump, much in the same vein of what Mattis and Allen and others had said. But this is what got me. He was talking about the statements that General Mattis and General Allen and General Kelly made about President Trump, where they were saying that he's a danger to the Constitution, that no president has been as divisive as President Trump. Colin Powell says after this, like after Jake Tapper shows him the clips, he's like, you know what? I'm just really proud of these young guys and what they're doing and their leadership they're showing. And he said, and to me, remember, I've been out of the military for 25 years. Mattis and Kelly and Allen were all junior officers when I left.
I took note of that as well.
I was like, whoa, man.
Yeah.
Because they look about the same age.
Right, yeah. Right.
They were boots.
To think of those guys as, you know, captains and young majors is wild to think about.
Yep.
And the experiences that Colin Powell has. When you look at the totality of somebody's life, Colin Powell is going to be up there with any American in U.S. history. And some of the most important and pivotal points, whether it be in Desert Storm or the role that he played in the riots that happened in L.A. and being like the voice of reason to President George H.W. Bush whenever he was talking about the language that they were going to use in the speech, that it was going to be much more law and order. But Colin Powell, as a general, gave him counsel like, look, you have to be more of a togetherness. You have to give some ground, show some grace here, and understand like the plight of Black people in this country. You can't just come out and be law and order guy. And H.W. took that to heart and did it. And then he came on, he was Secretary of State. You just look at his career, and to me, he's just a remarkable man. And the things that he stands for, I just really, really appreciate his style of leadership, his style of just grace under fire. I think he's incredible and knows his limits. He was asked if he was going to campaign, and he's like, no, that's not the kind of guy I am.
Like, if you like him so much, why don't you just marry him? Jeez.
I would. If Colin Powell was like, do you want to be my sister wife? I would be like, yes.
Yes. Man, he was born in 1937.
I was just going to say, I actually just pulled it up. I had no idea this gentleman was 83 years old. I never would have guessed
that. Yeah, I wouldn't have.
He doesn't look any older than 65. And the way that he carries himself and the way that he speaks, he went to a small school in New York and came to be not just the Allied commander in Desert Storm, but also the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of State. Just an incredible legacy that he's leaving. I really like Colin Powell a lot.
Son to two immigrants, it should be mentioned, which when you think about how old he is, that's actually not that surprising. But yeah, just an unbelievable accomplished man. And the fact that he's still around and still giving his vantage point on everything is interesting. And I'm kind of curious what you two think. Would you want to be one of these people that anytime basically anything happens, people run to get your opinion? And he's given his opinion just about on every topic under the sun.
We are. Like it happened.
No, to his extent.
Yeah, to that extent. I feel like sometimes we are like, because of the nature of our job and what we talk about, there is a point that we have to have an instantaneous take on things. And I don't like to have an instantaneous take on things.
Oh, I do.
I want to see how things can develop.
I'm a knee jerker. Hard on my sleeve. Also, social media guy Kyle just brought up a really great point to me. Colin Powell's 83. I am 34. That is the exact same age of the Civil War couple from last episode. So Katie I'm just Powell. Saying, Katie Powell, think about it. Rolling around in your head. Something to marinate.
So a message to Donald Trump, leave Mr. Powell alone. Just leave him alone. We don't need any of those mean
tweets.
Step
away from the Powell.
Just rise above. Sometimes you gotta rise above.
I think that there's certain people that are more or less untouchable. I think
he's like the Tom Hanks of the military world. Leave him alone.
He came in third for president and didn't even run.
Yeah,
that was kind of funny.
Says a lot
about that.
I wish he had. Yeah,
but I think he's done enough that he is above getting chirped at.
I agree. All right, let's move on to round number three from the baby girls. What do we got, Kate?
From the baby girls themselves. Well, no, this isn't from the baby girls. This is the Confederate flag thing.
Yeah, but we went on with the baby girls.
I wanted to see what else is banned.
Oh, okay. Well, should we read the story first and then do the baby girls thing?
Yep.
Doesn't matter. Sorry. Round number three. Round number three coming to us from Stars and Stripes. The Marine Corps has banned most public displays of a controversial... Fuck me. Ha ha. Most public displays? They didn't ban all?
It goes on to explain why.
All right, round number three. The Marine Corps has banned most public displays of a controversial Confederate symbol, including on clothing, mugs, bumper stickers, truck nuts, pretty much anything you can think of at installations worldwide.
Even Calvin and Hobbes. Can't even rip a piss on it.
You can't even the Confederate battle flag has all too often been co-opted by violent extremist and racist groups and enormous pieces of shit whose divisive beliefs have no place in our core, said the official Twitter account. Wow, I can't believe the official Twitter account
said that. Yeah, that was a loose translation there by Kate. I think that was the King James version.
Yeah.
Not the New English Standard.
They followed that up with a tweet that just said duty balls. Very strange.
Yeah, that was weird.
The move, announced in a message that day, says commanders must exercise best judgment and discretion when inspecting workspaces, public areas, yada yada, to remove those stars and bars. Get them out. They say, you get out. Marine Corps Commandant General David Berger addressed the unrest in a statement on Wednesday, saying current events are a stark reminder that it is not enough for us to remove symbols that cause division. Rather, we must also strive to eliminate division itself. The Marine Directive does not apply to the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Virginia or other displays that address the Civil War from a neutral, historical, or educational perspective. And a lot of people, first of all, I feel like there's no ifs, ands, or buts. If you're still fighting to keep that flag around, you're a fucking moron. Sorry. Like, I hate you. You're a stupid piece of shit.
It's also ridiculous. It's about heritage.
No. Wait. So I want to address that. Because guess what Stone Cold Steve Austin said? There was this woman. He was saying kind of the same thing. Like, get this flag the fuck out of here. And this fan of his, April Vickery, commented on his Instagram post. And she said, for us, it wasn't a sign of hatred or hate or ignorance. It's a sign of Southern pride and a pride in who you are and where you come from. And for the people that you know who stood for heritage and lineage and family and pride that never stood for hate ever. And he said to her, he came running down the ramp. There was smoke on the Instagram page. He came and he came ripped off his leather vest. And he said, that's nice and all. But if I recall, it don't matter what it means to you. It don't matter what it means to you, because to African Americans everywhere, it's a symbol of oppression, hatred, inequality. So your little heritage, not hate story, don't mean shit, because your stupid little heritage was built on the backs of slaves, and identifying with that kind of sorta definitely makes you trash in the Texas rattlesnake's eyes. So you can continue to spew your bullshit, but just know that none of us care, you dumb racist some bitch, and that's the bottom line. Get him!
Because Stone Cold said so.
You would have told me 20 years ago that woke Stone Cold was a thing.
Yes.
I would be like, get the fuck out of town.
I would have thought
he would be like the biggest Southern. And people are like, oh, it's about heritage. There's fucking stars and bars in Maine, dude. Maine is not a Southern state.
Right.
Spoiler alert, it's not.
It's not
about that.
I'm sorry.
The symbol of something changes over a long period of time. I'll give you another Bible example, because I know Kant loves it whenever I'm a Bible guy.
Of course
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the early Roman days, the main form of public execution was the cross. It was seen much like a noose or like an electric chair would be, because that's the way that they persecuted people outside of cities. That's the way that they killed people if they did the ultimate thing wrong. It was the worst one, and sometimes they would turn it upside down. The cross has gone from a symbol that is much like in the Roman days, it was considered to be the electric chair.
Imagine
now it's the symbol of Christianity.
Imagine wearing a cute little
over time.
Cute little necklace with an electric chair on it. If Jesus had been,
well, you guys want to know how woke? You want to know how woke seminarian I used to be?
Sure.
Yes.
I wrote a paper in college that was called the idolization of the cross, that I thought that people had turned the cross into a sense of a worship, and that it was just the means of death. The method of death didn't matter, but it was the death itself that needed to be recognized, and people were constantly looking at the cross like an idol.
Kind of looking at it like a hornet's nest with hornets buzzing at them. Making fun of your analogies. Anyways, I'm so tired of people at this point, after hearing what your fellow Americans have to say and how it makes them feel, if you're still like trying to keep around, I'm sorry. I have no patience for you anymore. You are a real, like, in the words of Stone, you're a dumb son bitch. Okay. Cut it out. Stop
it. And that's the bottom
line. Yeah. That's the bottom line.
I'm all for honoring the past, but when your past involves racism and hatred, I think so many people, they get hung up and they think like it's a bad thing to like move past that and to recognize that where they came from might have been, you know, sorry to say, pretty bad back in the day.
A little bad.
So it's okay to say like, hey, we don't want to honor these people anymore. We want to take these statues down. We want to change the names of things. I think that's okay.
And that's the process of growth, right? Growth as a civilization, growth as a culture. You can look back and say, Thomas Jefferson did a great thing in penning the Declaration of Independence and writing the Constitution. But him having slaves is bad.
You
could say those two things. You can have two sides of your mouth and say slavery in the practice of the Constitution of a black person was 3/5 of a vote. That was bad. Like, we shouldn't have done that as a nation. Like, they look at the Constitution like it's this golden ticket and completely perfect on its foundation is an absolute false premise that we have to move past in order to continue to move forward.
Also, Army, please get rid of those 10 Confederate bases named after Confederate. Like, come on. Like, just fucking do it already. We should. Duty
Fort
balls.
Baby girl.
Fort baby girl. Camp duty balls. all that good stuff.
I mean, there's plenty of people, even if they wanted to do kind of like the Navy does and did like Medal of Honor recipients. You could go through the list of Medal of Honor recipients from the Army and name every single installation on the country.
There's no shortage of names that we could pull out of our toolkit there.
The problem is that
How about some African-American
at some point?
African-American soldiers' names and women. How about a couple of those sprinkled in there on a fort from time to time? Army, wake up. Look, I'm just going to send Stone Cold over there to Fort Bragg. Anyways.
What about Fort Stone Cold?
I don't hate it. I don't hate it. The some bitch like division. First some bitch division. Checking in. Anyway, so
yeah, we should just start renaming forts based on wrestlers from our childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't mind that. You can have Fort Superfly Jimmy Snuka.
Fort Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah. You can have Fort Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Yeah, there's so much.
Fort the Nasty Rock. Boys.
Yeah. Fort the Rock.
I like it. I'm not mad at
Fort
it.
Fort Legion of Doom.
Anyways, we
Fort
went.
Fort Road Warrior. Fort Animal.
We asked our
Fork Jake the Snake
followers, our baby girls, what they would like to also see banned. The Confederate flag just got the boot in the Marine Corps, finally. What else would you like to see banned? We asked you, and you answered. JT Para 25 said, pooping during your analysis should be banned.
I disagree.
Sometimes it's natural.
Sometimes that's what you need to go.
Yeah.
And you know what? Yeah. I'm not above telling people that whatever method they need to utilize to get that urine analysis done, go ahead and do it.
Go ahead and do it. Right. Aged Bacon Actual, great name, said the word behoove. It would behoove you. Yeah, there's a couple words that definitely. John M. Reynolds said ban piggybacking off of what Chief said.
I agree with that. Yeah, that should be banned.
We piggyback all the time at the end of the show. We have one more thing. Actually, one more thing. Colton Lowe 7 said questions at final formation. That's even worse than piggybacking. When you're about to go and some junior troop's like, I have a question about.
Yeah. So tomorrow, is this crew supposed to bring this canteen?
PG gear.
Yeah, bitch. You're bringing your fucking glow belt and water source like you do every fucking day.
Yes. P.S. Parks 4839 said hands in pocket rule. Somebody else called the pockets, referred to them as your knife hand sheaths, where you put your knife hands, which I thought was adorable. Justin DRC, promoting people who can't read.
That's rough. Sometimes those promotion warrants are difficult, man. Like the way that things are phrased in military writing is very odd.
To all who presents greetings, presents greetings to all those.
Know
who
ye that reposing special trust and confidence in the fidelity and abilities of.
But I mean, how many? There's you'd have this solemn promotion thing, and then whoever was reading it could not read at
especially
all.
When there was like 10 or 15 names after Lance Corporal Digaboo.
Everybody fucking talking about Greg Young 25, the tradition of marrying at age 18. No, keep it. Let him get that BAE for a couple of years. There we go. V6 Camaros. Sean Keeley said ban V6 Camaros. Jay Lau said mandatory fun days. Yes, ban mandatory fun days for the love of God. This one, Salman Hammond said, grunt style and nine line merch at the BX. I didn't know they sold that stuff there on bases like that. I wasn't aware. Finland ban. Oh, this is a good one too. The ban on white socks and camis. Let us wear white socks and camis.
I agree. If your feet are so important, let's just have it. If it's desert camis, I'm okay with it. Yeah, not woodlands. It's too much of a clash.
I wore on my first deployment. That's all I wore was white socks.
Yeah, deployment was okay.
Jared Arkeo 23 said being allowed to walk and talk on the phone in camis and garrison.
That's nasty.
What?
That's very nasty.
See,
yeah,
it took
I hate
me.
That.
It
I
took
still
me,
don't do that.
It took me over a year after I got out to finally feel like I could do that, like comfortably without looking around.
Well, you guys remember whenever I flew to New York once and I told you that I had my headphones in while I was walking in the airport, and that was like a big moment for me that I thought I was being nasty.
Yeah. Reuben the Rascal said, back in the saddle training after Christmas and New Year's 96s, man, I haven't heard the term back in the saddle training in a hot minute. But it's like, it's like 2 days worth of awful PowerPoints reminding you you're back at work again. Like,
the best one might be Kyle's that he put out with the questions, ban saluting officers. I think everybody would be on board with that.
You think?
Nobody likes salute. Even Kyle, you didn't like saluting, right?
It can get annoying. I mean, so I'll say this. I like it in formations and ceremonies. I think it's awesome. But just like walking around and getting saluted all the time.
Yeah, like you're trying to go to Subway. I don't need to salute a fucking second lieutenant while I'm going to get a turkey sub. But if you're doing like turnover to a platoon, like in a formation, I could see that because that's like customs and courtesy and heritage. Yeah, so I actually do like that aspect. But there's a lot of things that need to be banned. I think the Army eventually will get pressured by the Marine Corps and like what they're doing there to make some of these changes, because if it brings hurt to your troops, and we've seen that, like seeing several different videos, why do it? I've never really understood it. It really doesn't make a lot of sense to constantly celebrate through monuments. And people could say monuments are a picture of history. Well, you don't put really shitty players out in front of sports stadiums. You put Michael Jordan, you put fucking Kobe Bryant. You don't put, let's see, who's really a Blaine Gabbert's not going to get a statue in front of the Jaguar Stadium. Just not going to happen.
Yeah. Ask the people of Iraq how they felt about that statue of Saddam coming down. They were pretty pumped about that.
Yeah.
And two, just also, like,
well, I was going to say real quick, credit to Kyle. Thank you, Kyle. There were two comments about things to ban. One said ban service academy officers, and the other said ban Army football. You left those off of the sheet. So I appreciate that from Kyle.
I left them off the sheet, but I felt them in my heart, and I was going to say them to you afterwards anyway.
Oh, okay.
Also, I like this one. Redbeard Golf, he tells a quick story about something that did get banned also. It says, when I was at Barksdale in the mid-2000s, a colonel's wife was shocked by someone who had truck nuts, truck nuts, hanging off their personal vehicle, and the commander banned truck nuts. I love that somebody had to write up an official military thing banning truck nuts.
What do you think he called it? What do you think he called it in the official write-up?
Definitely not truck nuts. Definitely. What do we call them? Dangling
testicular vehicle adornments.
Yeah. Testicular vehicle, something like that. Decorative, whatever. Yeah, definitely. Definitely fun. Definitely fun stuff there. But yeah, I'm all about. Let's move forward on that stuff.
In summary, it's okay to change. It's okay to adapt and grow.
Yes. Also, one last thing too. You know, thinking about
caveat.
It. Just let me piggyback. It would behoove you guys to listen to me as a caveat. But I don't think we can overkill it. Now there's a lot of black service members who at very high levels are speaking out and talking about their time coming up in the military and finally saying, as a high ranking commander, here's X, Y, and Z. Here's a lot of examples of the racism and pain that I faced from the own military that I love. And fellow service members coming up in the military. And one was from the commander of the Pacific Air Forces. He's a senior leader in the Air Force. And Major General, is that what? Yeah. So his was so powerful to me. It's been viewed almost 3 million times now. And I think that these generals and high-ranking people are coming out to say, yes, this is a thing, and that it's hurt us to be quiet about it for so long. And I can't imagine then hearing that pain and then having to check in at a base named after a Confederate, whatever. Like, I get it. I think it's really, really way past time to change that shit. Like, seriously. So I was wondering if we could play that clip because it was just really moving to me. And
we can. Here it is.
Okay.
As the commander of Pacific Air Forces, a senior leader in our Air Force, and an African-American, many of you may be wondering what I'm thinking about the current events surrounding the tragic death of George Floyd. Here's what I'm thinking about. And think about how full I am with emotion, not just for George Floyd, but the many African Americans that have suffered the same fate as George Floyd. I'm thinking about protests in my country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, the equality expressed in our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that I've sworn my adult life to support and defend. And thinking about a history of racial issues and my own experiences that didn't always sing of liberty and equality. I'm thinking about living in two worlds, each with their own perspective and views. I'm thinking about my sister and I being the only African-Americans in our entire elementary school and trying to fit in. I'm thinking about then going to a high school where roughly half the students were African-American and trying to fit in. I'm thinking about my Air Force career, where I was often the only African-American in my squadron or as a senior officer, the only African-American in the room. I'm thinking about wearing the same flight suit with the same wings on my chest as my peers, and then being questioned by another military member, are you a pilot? And thinking about how I sometimes felt my comments were perceived to represent the African-American perspective when it's just my perspective informed by being African-American. I'm thinking about some of the insensitive comments made without awareness by others. I'm thinking about being a captain at the Oak Club with my squadron and being told by other African Americans that I wasn't black enough since I was spending more time with my squadron than with them. I'm thinking about my mentors and how rarely I had a mentor that looked like me. I'm thinking about the sound advice that has led to my success, and even so, most of my mentors could not relate to my experience as an African American. I'm thinking about the pressure I felt to perform error-free, especially for supervisors I perceive had expected less from me as an African American. I'm thinking about having to represent by working twice as hard to prove their expectations and perceptions of African Americans were invalid. I'm thinking about the airmen that have lived through similar experiences and feelings as mine, or who were either consciously or unconsciously unfairly treated. Conversely, I'm thinking about the airmen who don't have a life similar to mine and don't have to navigate through two worlds. I'm thinking about how these airmen view racism, whether they don't see it as a problem since it doesn't happen to them, or whether they're empathetic. I'm thinking about our two sons. Now we had to prepare them to live in two worlds. I'm thinking about the frank and emotional conversations my wife and I have had with them just this past week as we discussed the situations that have led to the protests around our country. Finally, I'm thinking about my historic nomination to be the first African American to serve as the Air Force Chief of Staff. I'm thinking about the African Americans that went before me to make this opportunity possible. I'm thinking about the immense expectations that come with this historic nomination, particularly through the lens of current events plaguing our nation. I'm thinking about how I may have fallen short in my career and will likely continue falling short, living up to all those expectations. I'm thinking about how my nomination provides some hope, but also comes with a heavy burden. I can't fix centuries of racism in our country, nor can I fix decades of discrimination that may have impacted members of our Air Force. I'm thinking about how I can make improvements personally, professionally, and institutionally, so that all airmen, both today and tomorrow, appreciate the value of diversity and can serve in an environment where they can reach their full potential. I think I don't have all the answers on how to create such an environment, whether here in PACAF or across our Air Force. I'm thinking about, without clear-cut answers, I just want to have the wisdom and knowledge to lead during difficult times like these. I want the wisdom and knowledge to lead, participate in, and listen to necessary conversations on racism, diversity, and inclusion. I want the wisdom and knowledge to lead those willing to take committed and sustained action to make our Air Force better. That's what I'm thinking about. I want to know what you're thinking about. I want to hear what you're thinking about and how together we can make a difference.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Major General doing that is great. It's surprising. Like, it's almost surprising to see political, like what we would consider to be political, even though it's not, like having a take that could be controversial while you're wearing the uniform is surprising. I think it's a great thing that people all across different branches are doing and speaking up and being open and honest about. Let's move on to round number four, which is going to be the interview with Jim Dunn. And that's going to be brought to you by our good friends at Simply Safe. Ooh. Should we do FDR?
Do you have any other good impressions you do?
Yeah. Actually, somebody asked me if I could do an entire ad read in Winnie the Pooh voice and stick with it.
Whoa, I don't know if you can.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one. Here we go.
Oh, God.
What's the number one sign of a bad home security? A home security system that's so complicated, you never use it. This is exactly the type of security Simply Safe has spent a decade fighting against. They believe that simple is safer. And that's exactly why Simply Safe is the home security for right now, when feeling safe at home has never been more important. Simply Safe was designed for easy to use while protecting your home 24/7. Order online and click a button. Open the box, place a sensor, plug it in, and your home is protected around the clock. No technician or salesperson has to come and disrupt your house. You don't need to pay any outrageous monthly fees or sign a 2-year contract. Simply Safe was named the best home security of 2020 by U.S. News and World Reports. And the 24/7 personal monitoring and emergency dispatch.
at 50 cents a day. Head to simplysafe.com/CBT and get free shipping and a 60-day money-back guarantee. That's simplysafe.com/CBT to make sure that they know that we sent you.
Simply Safe's gonna love that. Simply Safe Home Security. Well, promo code ZBT. They're gonna love
better
it.
That than I think Eeyore. Eeyore probably would have been.
Would have been very sad. Yeah.
Simply Safe.
That too. DIGGEERR. Mm-hmm. Why? You know, Winnie the Pooh could have used the Simply Safe Home Security.
Oh yeah.
Because people are trying to steal his honey.
Oh honey.
Yes.
I have a honey plate right here. I had biscuits and honey this morning.
Such a honey guy.
Awesome.
Like a little bit of a bear. All right, let's move on. This story that we have actually is awesome. It's one of the main reasons why I wanted to start a show like this is for people to have what I would call the library of their brain stored somewhere. Because a lot of times there's been so many veterans over the course of this great country that have passed away and their stories have died alongside with them because they weren't written down. They weren't documented in books. But each and every person's experiences in war is completely unique to themselves. And we see the take that I could have on Fallujah might be different from somebody else's. Kate's take on Afghanistan might be different from somebody else's. Khan's experience as an officer is different than another captain somewhere else. I think that each one of our stories is individual and they're special. And being able to share those stories that haven't been shared before is great. This is exactly what this is. Jim Dunn came back from Vietnam after being shot by a motherfucking machine gun and never talked about it. He talks about that experience of going from being in Vietnam in the jungles and flying 1,600 hours of missions to going to an area where he was surrounded by academicians who never wanted to talk about war, who acted like it didn't happen, and no one even gave a fuck. I can't imagine what that was like. Here's Jim Dunn telling us what it was like. All right, this next interview is one that I'm really excited about because when I first started this show, I had dreams of what the show would be like and what kind of stories we would tell. And a lot of times we've been fortunate on this show. We've had Medal of Honor recipients like Woody Williams that was just on the show. We've had Kyle Carpenter and Dakota Meyer and many other Medal of Honor recipients. But a lot of times through war and through just the way that history falls, we don't have the opportunity to hear stories that are lesser known. And some of those stories are just as remarkable as the ones that have high levels of valor, like a Medal of Honor. This story is different. This gentleman that we're about to interview, his son reached out to me and showed me one article, and that was basically all I could find, which I found to be shocking considering the awards that he has, like 4 Distinguished Flying Crosses, which is unbelievable to me. So without further ado, we're going to have someone who rarely, if ever, has talked about his combat experiences. Jim Dunn is joining the show. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to talking with you.
Now, I want to get in, before we get into some of your combat escapades and your combat experiences, I want to talk to you because you're a Vietnam-era veteran. Is that the reason why you were quiet, even amongst your family, about some of your experiences that you had?
Well, to be very frank with you, when I came back from Vietnam, I was injured, so I was carried back in a stretcher all the way to Kentucky, where I got out and went up to visit my family eventually. It was, I didn't really get the walking out of the terminal, walking out of the plane. I mean, it was all just grateful. I had great receptions. I was on a hospital plane, so everywhere we landed, everybody came out to talk to the veterans. And I literally had no idea that things were as bad as they eventually were when I finally got out of the hospital. I gradually saw that occurring. But to make a long story short, I had a lot of things that I really wanted to share with people when I left. But when I started to see the reactions of people, I really felt strange and just wasn't certain they wanted to talk about them. And to be very frank with you, nobody really asked. It was a strange situation. You know, I had the best example I could give you is when I eventually was able to walk. I walked, had crutches. I went to a party when I got back to my home in Detroit, Michigan, and showed up in my crutches. I hadn't been around my buddies for a year and a half. I got there and someone said, "Hey, I understand you were in the Army for a while. By the way, how are the Tigers doing?" that kind of thing. And
wow,
it just wasn't something I wanted to pursue. I kind of find myself, quite frankly, be someone who doesn't like to toot his own horn.
And I find that, to me, that's heartbreaking, because I can't imagine keeping my stories in, because they shaped so much of not only who I am as a man, but just my worldview and how I view things, how I view government, how I view politics was all shaped by what I saw in a combat zone. And I'm sure that you were the same way, and keeping quiet about that and feeling like nobody wanted to hear, to me, is heartbreaking. And that trip you took with the Red Cross, it wasn't just a short little flight. That was a flight from Japan all the way to Kentucky on a stretcher.
Yeah. I was on a
even that.
Yeah. It was incredible. I've got to tell you, I'll never forget, as long as I live, being on that hospital plane where they literally had surgeries ongoing. They had operating rooms set up. And I had the honor of being with all those returning wounded soldiers. I was the very bottom of the last of the plane. I froze my butt off, quite frankly, all the way back, because I was so close to the door, but I wasn't about to say anything with all the medical things going on around me. It was incredible.
I bet. And it's kind of breathtaking, like, to be around. I remember being in the Fallujah Ambulatory Center where people we're getting ready to be transported out to Bagram and different places like that after losing limbs. And I'm sitting there just I got shot through the arm, and I was thinking, man, I don't deserve to be in the same room as these guys and what they're going through. And I'm sure you felt kind of the same way. Like, it's always humbling to be around other warriors, because you get pointed out for sacrificing something, and you know, if you're still alive, you know that there's people who sacrifice much more.
Absolutely. I feel exactly the same. My injuries were minor compared to those injuries that I saw and tended to, I'm sure, much like you.
And you went on, after your career in the Army, you went on to become a lawyer, and we'll get into that a little bit, but you had a successful career after you left. But I want to get into some of the actual stories, because when I was reading through some of your citations that your son was nice enough to go over, I saw that you had 1,600 hours of combat flight time. Is that correct?
That's correct. 1,632, actually.
And I know a lot of the people that listen are military and enlisted folks, so I'm going to do the math for you. That's almost 67 complete days of combat operation hours, actually conducting combat. Now, thinking about it from the war on terror perspective, whenever I would go into a combat zone like Afghanistan or Iraq, we would usually be gone for 3 or 4 days at a time. But a lot of that wasn't happening where it was continuous. The nature of your job, could you tell us what the nature of your job and what each and every moment of those 1,600 hours kind of felt like?
Well, remember, I came from the ground. I was an artillery forward observer, and I was with a unit that had a lot of combat initially when I got there and survived. So people thought I was capable of doing my job. So I got this offer because they wanted to have a combat experience person. They took these soldiers, four or five of us, and put us into these positions. We flew OH-13 helicopters and the L-119 bird dogs. And we were on station. The 1st Infantry Division used us all the time. I mean, I had many days when it was 20 hours of flying. And the only reason it wasn't 24 is because we had to stop and get fuel and use the bathroom and things of that nature.
Right.
And it was incredible. We flew low where appropriate to draw fire and to, you know, help mark targets. And we were so good that the artillery virtually was involved in every single situation we had. It was much more of a jungle scenario where we were. It was very hard to see. When I was originally a forward observer, I learned to adjust fire by sound, quite frankly. And wow. I couldn't see anybody in the jungle against us. I saw a lot of my own troops getting hurt, but it was very hard to see anybody shooting at you. So
And this area is just so different than what the modern warrior goes through now, too. Because I was picturing myself when I was reading through some of your citations and trying to kind of wrap my head around it and put myself in that position. But being in a jungle environment like you were makes it so much more difficult, because I saw that at times, whenever you were a forward observer in the air, essentially, you would have to be able to identify enemy versus friendly forces, sometimes as close as 17 meters apart.
Yes, we were right at tree lines on a regular basis. And you're referring to a situation that occurred on the first day of the Tet Offensive, actually, where I literally, along with my pilot, we were engaged in literally ground warfare. We were probably 25 feet high, taking on a platoon of North Vietnamese and doing pretty well at it. We survived, didn't get shot down, and we took, you know, we inflicted some casualties and saved some lives in that span. And that from there to 2,000 feet, 2,500 feet, where we normally adjusted, or down as low as 1,000 sometimes, or 500. We went as low as we needed to go to get the job done.
And see, I find that remarkable. For me as a ground guy who spent my career in combat actually like fighting on the ground, if I had the opportunity and I was in a helicopter, I'm not sticking around like in a lot of those situations. I probably would have flown up high into the clouds and got the hell out of there.
Well, I must admit, there was a tremendous, I just was with people that had such a desire to do things well. It just swept us up. I hate to sound like a religious zealot, but we were literally just carried away by our enthusiasm. We were probably a little stupid and too cocky, but it was probably that type of attitude in some instances that might have actually saved our lives. Because as you know, in combat, you know, when the minute you hold up, or the minute you let up, the minute you start to get nervous, that's the minute the problems start. You have to really be bold in most situations, in my opinion.
And when you were flying through, so for those that don't look, you're looking out of the helicopter while the pilot is flying, and you're trying to spot the enemy so that you could, in some spots where I was reading, where you're throwing smoke grenades in order to spot, so artillery sees where to take out the enemy. Was that something that took, how did you train for that, and how did you learn it on the fly, essentially? Because that's not what you originally did.
No, you really didn't train for it. Interestingly enough, it was probably more common. When we flew in the helicopter, we always flew in a helicopter with two control scenarios. We had armored seats, which eventually saved my life when I was wounded. But we because it was often, we weren't sure who was going to get shot. And as a forward observer going to an aerial observer, they basically taught us how to fly at the plane and the helicopter in the event we had to get it down because the pilot was not with us. It never happened, to be honest with you, but it could have. It wasn't, you know, the interesting thing is in Vietnam, you were just contained. Once you had an operation that started and you started to get into combat, you didn't want to leave. You wanted to be there. You wanted to be the eyes and ears of the guys on the ground that couldn't see, you know, beyond them that they're in this jungle clearing, that there was a clearing 50 meters ahead, or that, mm-hmm. or that, you know, that they were dropping bombs that we would also act as facts on occasion and, you know, bring in our own jets. And we flew low often because it was impossible to see anything high, quite frankly. And we got used to it. We had a couple of planes shot up, even shot down on a regular basis, but we were literally asked for every single ground operation we could. There were a total of five of us. Three of us basically were on a regular rotation. We were every single day, probably 20 hours a day, we could have flown for a unit that wanted us. The priority was always to go to combat. And the interesting thing is, looking back, I was probably in combat every day for hours, you know, many hours, sometimes 24 hours or more. Because once we got in combat, we didn't want to leave. You know, once we were the eyes and ears of that forward observer on the ground who couldn't see ahead of him, who didn't know where he was at, didn't know how to adjust the Air Force jets and the Army gunships and so forth. And that was, it fell to us often to do that. And we did it great.
And with that amount of time that you're in heavy engagements, how did you stay focused? Because I know a lot of guys that we talk to, a lot of ladies that we talk to, they will say, you know, like complacency starts to set in. When you're leaving Camp Fallujah, or you're leaving Marja's bases, whenever you're going out, you have these huge signs that say complacency kills. How did you, that many hours a day for that long of time, how did you maintain focus?
Well, I know this might sound a little overwhelming, but we were often, I mean, most of our time was engaged. We did have situations arise where we weren't as focused, but we weren't anywhere near combat either when that was happening. We were just, I can remember one time literally flying an L-119. I wasn't the pilot, I was in the back seat, and we were watching a convoy. Well, the convoy was about as boring as you could get. And we had a situation develop where we lost a wheel. I don't want to describe it any more than that, but it was a little difficult to account for it. So we had to find the enemy somewhere to get shot at so that we could justify having the wheel gone.
Yeah, because you get in trouble if you came back without it. Exactly. I mean, that's just the way it goes.
So we were very engaged.
Yeah, I bet. And then can you walk us through the moment of the day that you were actually shot, whenever you're on another low-flying mission? Can you walk us through what happened there?
Sure. So in the 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam, the division was located at Lai K, and to the north was the Cambodian border, probably 50 miles away, heavy jungle and the occasional clearing, and anything north of that for all practical purposes was the enemy. To the south was Saigon, another 30 miles away, 40 miles away, different brand of different situation. So this operation was on the 5th of May. In fact, it was on my birthday. And this was after the Tet Offensive, after we had had a tremendous victory, quite frankly, but it wasn't viewed as such in history, but nonetheless it was. But you talk about engagement. That was a 48-hour engagement, that particular situation. Well, we went down to help a mechanized infantry unit. It was very rare that a mechanized infantry unit could go anywhere but roads or jungle. But they were in a rice paddy because it was in May, and this was the dry season. The monsoons wouldn't start till a little bit later in the summer. And they were going across rice paddies, basically. Still moist, but not anywhere near flooded. And our job was to be available. It seems almost absurd, but there was so little cover that it was amazing that in one particular tree line where there were probably maybe 10, 20 yards of shrubbery, you could hide a Viet Cong company, basically. It was probably about 30 guys, maybe a platoon for them, maybe not very much company for them. Make a long story short, we flew over the convoy and we were headed to this growth of trees to see what was there. We were too low because we didn't think anybody was there. And when we got there, right over the tallest tree, and I looked right down at a 50 caliber machine gun and knew that we were in trouble because that baby was capable of shooting us down. And everybody that we were with thought there was nothing there. So I immediately got on the radio, told the commander what was going on. He immediately increased his speed to try to get there. And we started to go up. And the mistake that we made going up was that we pulled up almost immediately and turned to the right. And of course, that's a deadly error. But in order to mark the position, we had to turn around and go back rather than keep going up. And we did. We turned around and went back. At the same time, we were trying to gain some speed, dropped smoke grenades on the location, and received 50 caliber machine gun fighting as the indicator. So we knew we had the right spot. Bullets were hitting the canopy. They were hitting the armored seats. We were still flying. And suddenly we weren't. We were headed down. And that's basically all I remember, quite frankly. But I'm told that we landed in a rice paddy and basically worked our way out waiting for the armored mechanized infantry to come and join us. The helicopter was on its side. Myself and the fellow flying were on the other side, and it's my understanding he did not survive.
Wow. And did you get shot? Did you get injured by shrapnel, or did a round go through?
No, a round went through my foot, took out my
major. Damn it. See, I hate when somebody's on the show that got shot with a bigger caliber weapon than me. 50 cal. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Well, I'll tell you. When it went through my joint on my right foot, the major joint, it took out the whole major joint. I thought my foot was gone. I looked down and my toes were pointed to the shoe was pointed way to the right. And I thought, well, I don't
have any toes. Did it go through like your Achilles? Like you're through the Achilles?
No, no. It was right at the main ball joint where you step by your toe. It had come through there, and it just took off the – it didn't take off the toes, but it took off a big chunk of what was behind the toes, and it put it – took care of the boot so that the boot, in effect, was flapping to the right. The front had been there, and I was hanging on by skin of the second, third toes, basically. But it was an interesting – you know, and then I got to – the field hospital, and from there I spent some time a couple days before they could get me to Saigon, and then it was a couple days before I could get out of Saigon to Japan. Because
when you woke up in the hospital, because you said that you didn't remember, you were just laying there on your side. When you woke up in the hospital, what was some of the first things that went through your mind? Do you remember?
Sure. What happened? I wanted to know that we won the operation, which we did. I mean, it was basically a small skirmish to start with. But I have a feeling, you know, it turned out that there was a lot of heavy weapons involved, and the North Vietnamese were the soldiers involved. So they were fairly, you know, they probably got caught, quite frankly, in an area that they weren't prepared for, because they never would have been in such a small amount of brush. I mean, it was literally, couldn't be no more than a house lot is, you know, 100 by 200 feet. But they had a lot in that thing, including a number of 50 calibers.
So and one thing that I picked up on that you mentioned that I used to as well, too, you mentioned the mistake that was made whenever you were trying to fly up, that you're going up and to the right. Is that something that you Monday morning quarterback for a long time, where you thought about the tactical mistake that was made?
You know, I did, quite frankly. I thought we, you know, we should have stayed down, and it would have been a lot harder to hit us. We could have come back over the top lower. We went in low, and we surprised them. That worked out well. But when we went up, we just were sitting ducks, because not only did you go up, you could see us, but you also slow down. And we're already in an OH-13, which is probably 100 miles an hour anyways. It's not a hard thing to hit once you slow down even more with the 50 caliber.
And you said the pilot that you were with was KIA that day, correct?
Yes, correct.
Can you describe what your relationship was like with a pilot before something like that happens out, obviously?
Well, he was stayed with the pilots that we flew with. So we knew all the pilots and their abilities, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. He was a good guy, had flown a while, but because they flew the entire time they were in Vietnam, it took me 6 months to get into this position. I didn't. There wasn't quite the camaraderie with the pilots that there was between the observers. And in order to be an observer, you had to be selected literally by the commanding general of the division, and you had to have a lot of combat time. So a lot of the pilots, of course, had never been on the ground in combat. All the observers had been. I was.
And you had done things with the Big Red One. That was the unit that you had deployed with.
That's correct. I was with the 1st of the 16th Infantry. And Big Red One was a great fighting unit, great esprit de corps. And it was when I was on the ground, again, we were in action all the time. We would come back occasionally for a few days at a time to get beefed up with personnel and rest a little bit. But it wasn't long before we were back out there again.
And so you go from there after you get home from the long Red Cross flight from Japan to get back to the United States. You end up getting promoted. You do a tour in Korea as well on the DMZ. And then you come back to America again, where you are the captain of a company commander, essentially, of an artillery unit. And then you decide to get out of the military. Now, somebody with your level of awards, your level of accomplishments, because during that time, I mean, to rack up 4 Distinguished Flying Crosses, to have a Bronze Star, a Purple Heart, an Air Medal with a V, that's 5-6 Valor devices in one deployment, which to me is mind-blowing. You get out and you become an attorney. With those level of stories, going back to what we talked about at the beginning, I don't know how you keep that bottled up. Like I try to put myself in the position of the Vietnam era warrior, and I just can't. I don't know how you, I can't stop talking about my experience, especially if I have a couple beers. I will talk about it a lot. And it's, I just don't know how you, was it a struggle for you to keep that internally, or what, did it just become second nature?
Well, I had two things. Actually, I was still in the Army when I got out of the hospital. And I went to Fort Dix, New Jersey as a company commander. When I was in Vietnam, I'd actually had a spell for about 2.5 weeks where I was the platoon leader and then eventually the company commander of the company that I was in there, because the company commander left under some sort of an injury, but we weren't in combat or anything like that. But, you know, I acted as the company commander. And it's funny because years later, I ended up getting awarded the MOS for the infantry. So not only was I an artillery officer, but I was also an infantry officer. But when I came back, I went to, after my deployment there.
Nice because nobody can call you a pogue anymore.
That's exactly right. So I went to Fort Sill for the officer's advanced course. But before that, I went to this work job at McGuire Air Force Base, right next to McGuire Air Force Base, Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I trained soldiers going to Vietnam, helped train soldiers going to Vietnam. And so I was still in the Army. I was still had a great camaraderie with people. And I had a couple operations on my foot in the process. And so I had people to talk to. It wasn't until when I went to officer's career course, then I went to career for a year and got out. It wasn't until I got back in the civilian world that I felt a little lonely, quite frankly. It was hard to explain what was going on. You know, when you're around a bunch of soldiers and, you know, you wear your dress uniform, you got a few ribbons, and you know people because they came back from where you were. So, you know what they did and, you know, they know what you did. It wasn't as hard to adjust. It was really hard leaving the military, quite frankly. I did it because when I got to Korea, I loved my assignment. I was right on the DMZ. And literally, we looked right out at North Korea from where I was at. And it was we were constantly in a state of readiness, and I loved it. And I realized, quite frankly, that I was probably addicted to this stuff. And maybe I needed to take a break for a while. So I went home, and that's when I found no one was interested. It was just the opposite. It was like, boy, you stupid, you went to Vietnam. And it was something I just kind of mulled over inside me for a while. I had a great family who always brought it out one way or the other. You know, I had a chance to talk to my uncle, who was a World War II soldier and on a regular basis. And I think he was helpful and instrumental in giving me some ability to function as a normal civilian.
And not just like a normal day-to-day life, but the career path that you chose with dealing with academics and becoming a lawyer, it's even more so, I would imagine, where you had to keep it in that time period of what you had experienced. Because I can't imagine at law school, they were exactly pro-Vietnam at the time.
No. No one was. And I got to tell you, you were right on the money. No one not only was not pro-Vietnam, no one talked about it. I mean, they weren't interested. It was very rare. But I had a couple of buddies I got to know, and they were always interested enough to ask me how I was doing. And eventually it usually led to some sort of a discussion. I drank too much, and that was my solution, and it wasn't good. And it's a lesson I learned. It was a hard one, but eventually I stopped drinking, and that made a big difference at the time. And I was very fortunate to have a great family around me. I've got the greatest sons you could possibly want. They're all just
and you can tell they love you. Like just the messages that I've gotten, that they're immensely proud that you're their dad, and I think that that's awesome. Whenever I look back on my life and get to the stage of the life you're at, I hope my kids look at me the same way when they're adults, and I think it's fantastic, and it shows resiliency to come back from the combat that you had while not being able to speak to someone. I can't imagine where my life would be if I didn't have the opportunity to go to counseling and things like that. And so many from your generation just had to essentially suck it up. And I can't imagine how difficult that was.
It was, but eventually I made it to the counseling. I did all that. My wife has been, you know, right there with me all the way, even now. I just recently, maybe a couple years ago, was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease as a result of Agent Orange. And I've had that kind of situation, you know, bladder cancer, Agent Orange. So the military hasn't left me. But I'll tell you what, it was the greatest experience of my life, and it made me what I am. And I'm just proud of the fact that I serve with the people I serve with. One of the most interesting things, and I shouldn't just monopolize this, and I apologize, I serve with two Medal of Honor winners. Two wow. Medal of Honor winners. Now, that's the kind of people that were around me. That's incredible. Rough.
Who was it?
Well, the first one was a fellow by the name of Pinky Durham. He was a Ford observer, and he was there at the same time I was. I was overflying.
What a name, Pinky, man.
Yeah. And he literally died calling the artillery in on himself because he was getting overrun. And it was an awful situation.
I remember reading that.
It was really bad. And then the other person is a great story, if you don't mind me sharing it with you.
No, absolutely.
It was a gentleman by the name of Charles Rogers, a black man, who came to Vietnam, came in as the S3, because I was billeted at the division headquarters, and he was the S3. And myself and another AO had gone out on a mission. And what often happened sometimes was that we were so far away, didn't make sense to come back. We would just change pilots or aircraft and then stay out. We often stayed out for days at a time, never really carrying anything, but in combat, so nobody really noticed it anyways, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. So right. We came back, and one day, the two of us were a little bit too cocky and a little bit too wise. We came back, and this S3 major wanted to see us, this Major Rogers. So we didn't know who he was because he had come while we had gone out. He was the acting S3. We went to see him, and he went up.
With all the stuff that you guys are doing, you're probably feeling like King Dingalings, honestly.
You're not kidding. We are feeling really cool. Because we had the division commander on our side. I mean, there were more than one occasion when I would ask the division commander to please call a colonel and tell him I'm supposed to be doing these things, and basically telling him what to do.
Right.
So Major Rogers said, you know, you guys have terrible radio contact and all kinds of stuff. And make a long story short, we locked out of the building and we looked at each other and said, man, this guy is never going to make it. This is awful. Mm. If he still pulls that stuff, he's just not going to go anywhere. And people are going to, you know, really have trouble with him. Well, 6 months later, he won the Congressional Medal of Honor because he was
assigned. So he did all right.
He did a great job. He was assigned to a unit in the Big Red One and an airfield up by the Cambodian border, and led a counterattack after a couple of human wave attacks that literally demolished his compound and his artillery pieces. And he ended up leaving the service as a major general, the highest ranking minority officer or minority person ever in the military. Great guy once we got to know him, but we had been foolish and wrote him off because of what he told us about our radio etiquette.
Yeah, nobody likes to be told their radio etiquette sucks. I know that for sure. Exactly. So I want to, for the listeners that are listening while they're driving or doing whatever they're doing, you're wearing a Purple Heart hat. How long did it take you to get to the point where you would wear that?
I would say about maybe the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's kind of what we always talk about. When is it going to be okay for me to throw on the red retired Marine hat, the Purple Heart hat? And I always say, I think my age is going to be, I'll put it at like 63 or 64 will be my
overrun. You're not far off. You're right on the money. It's an old man hat. But you know, the interesting thing is, for the longest time, as we pointed out, I didn't need somebody to tell me I did a nice job. The nice thing now is you would be surprised. I am shocked at the people that come up at times and say thank you. People that on a regular basis. And I got to be honest with you, I kind of like it, not only because of the thanks, but I can see they needed somebody to say thanks to. And, you know, it is nice. And I urge you, it probably took me in the middle 60s, and I'm 75 now, so I've been wearing it, 5-6 years, maybe. You know, it'll take you a while. Put it on a little earlier. You might enjoy it earlier.
Yeah, I always make it a point. I still go to, my medical stuff is still on base, and I make it a point to any of the older gentlemen there, the Vietnam vets, the Korea vets, if I'm lucky enough still to see a World War II vet, I always go up and shake their hand and listen to their stories while we drink a little coffee and wait for our medicine to get there. It is something that I think really bridges the generational gap, because you have commonality. Like if I'm talking to somebody from World War II or Korea or Vietnam like yourself, we all have these same terms that we still use. We can all picture what it would have been like if we were there. And I think that that's the brotherhood, the sisterhood that makes the military so special.
It is. There's no question about it. You know, the other part of this is that when I went to Vietnam, I went over on a ship. And the interesting thing about the ship, it was the HH General Gordon. And we knew going to Vietnam that that was the ship that brought back all of the Special Forces troops that had been rescued from prisoner of war camps in World War II. And it was venerated. It just made me realize what a privilege I had to be going over as part of the 1st Infantry Division, because that was the same group that was so responsible in Europe for saving so many lives. And I'll never forget the people I served with. If I remember anything, it's them, because I don't remember much anymore.
Yep, that's what people always say. I don't miss the Army or I don't miss the Marine Corps, but I miss the soldiers and I miss the Marines. That's basically sums it up. And I think what you said there about the history is something special to be a part of. You definitely were that, sir. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us and your son for reaching out and telling us your story. It's fantastic. You deserve every single one of those handshakes that you get. We appreciate you coming on our show, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me and look forward to hearing more from you.
What a great guy. Just a great guy. What a
great, great person. Yep. Mm-hmm. Holy shit.
And his son reached out to me. I sent them a copy of the audio before it was released, and they said they hadn't heard some of those stories from their dad before. Just a really cool and interesting perspective on Vietnam. I can't imagine staying quiet about my experiences that shaped me as a person like he had and felt like he had to. I think it's just a eye-opening thing for people who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. We never experienced anything like that. And that's largely because the Vietnam folks said, we're never going to do this again.
Yeah.
So made a big difference there. All right, let's move on to round number five. We're going to talk a little bit about clothing and things like that. I want to pitch the question. All right, you had some time to think about it since I told you about it at the top of the show. You have one uniform that you have to wear 24/7 for the remainder of your life. You could take a shower, you could do all that stuff, but you have to wear this uniform forever. Which one is it? We'll start with you, Connor.
I honestly, I don't see how any of us could disagree on this, because it's none of the dress uniforms, because those certainly aren't comfortable. And a lot of the dress uniforms are such a fabric that would be disgustingly hot in the summer. Mm-hmm. It's got to be whatever your combat uniform is. So now for me, it was the ACU, which is now the OCP uniform in the Army.
The Army needs to stop it, by the way, with the amount of uniform change. What are you guys doing?
And they're so expensive every single time to change it.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah,
make a decision that sticks for a while.
I would agree. And because also the ACU, what a terrible looking pattern that was.
That was. It was absolutely Velcro terrible. And shit. Like, how is that fucking tactical?
I don't Velcro know. Velcro everywhere. So loud. It's so loud. Yeah. But the good thing about ACUs, BDUs, OCPs, the best part that we don't talk enough about, if you're out to eat and you spill something on yourself, you just rub that guy right in and it still looks fine. You can have spots that blend right in. It's perfect.
That's a good point.
So it's comfortable and you can have stains on it so you don't have to clean it as much.
Kate?
That would be my choice.
Man, so I've given this a lot of thought. Mm. And
there's two schools of thought.
There's two schools of thought. Yeah. One of the best things about being in the military is that, I mean, at least for me, because I hate fashion, I'm like a Kohl's, mom, give me the Kohl's cash. I'm going down to get some like dumb bullshit clothes. Anyways, I hate shopping. I hate clothes. So it's great to wear a uniform every day. Like to not have to worry about it. And you're right, Cons. You go a long, long, long time without washing those things if you wanted to with just a little bit of spray. Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. The only bummer, the only thing that really
got Victoria's Secret love spell.
Yeah. Oh man. Walking through formation at MP school when I was the only woman with a little bit of that on. Oh, 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 oh boy. I bet the doggies were barking. Anyway. Anyway. So you'd think I would say camis, but you'd be wrong. Because here's the thing that got my goose every single day. Taking on and pulling off my boots every day. Those things are just such a pain in the ass. You go back to your room at lunch, you want to take a quick nap-ski, quick 15-minute, fuck, do I take off my boots? You can't really sleep comfy in boots, but then you gotta take them off, but I'm gonna put them back on. Man, oh man, what a nightmare. So, that being said, I'm going with a move that I don't think anyone sees coming. And no, I'm not getting to the point. I'm still talking.
You clearly are not getting to the point.
It is the genuine USMC issued 100% woolly pulley sweater, okay, with the patches on it, because I'm always cold. Oh, yeah, and the slacks. And you know why? So that I can just wear easy slip-ons, my little easy little core frames. Just slip them on. I'm good to go. I can just
You're going to be so
up.
Hot, you're down the shore yeah. wearing a fucking woolly pulley?
I don't care.
Hey, let me just say, this is potentially the worst answer you've ever given on
yeah, that
show.
Was bad.
Get the...
That was real bad. I mean, I understand the shoes. My answer is boots and utes is my answer for there.
With a good sweatshirt, it's so good with a sweatshirt.
Or just like a green t-shirt that's like a few years old that you've been wearing forever. And then, because there's nothing like, whenever I would get home from work, I would go on my couch, unbutton the first two things of my trousers, mm-hmm. open up my black McMat belt, which I was a black belt McMat, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I have
no big deal.
I have my black belt opened up, and then I would kick off my boots and throw my feet up, keeping your trouser on whenever you release the boot bands from the bottom and having them just flow around your feet while you're walking mm-hmm. around. So comfy.
Yeah. You might as well be wearing pajamas.
Yep.
Well, this has made me rethink my answer. Okay. I have a new one.
Okay.
And this is good. I have one that trumps both of yours, hands down.
Oh.
I can't wait for it to not, but go ahead.
The camis.
Dress blue office.
The camis. But in your first week at boot camp, where you're wearing them unbloused to tenny runners.
Oh, that is a good answer. Wow. It's essentially the same thing. Yeah. But you're wearing mm-hmm. the blouse on the top. But I guess you are wearing, at the time we were wearing New Balances. That's a good answer,
yeah.
Kate.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Recruit. I don't care if I look dumb. I want to be a week one recruit. Yeah.
Recruit Katie. Back at it again. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good one. Another question off the top of my head. This one came from the Twitter people too. Our baby girls. So
ooh, baby girls.
What animal, if they could speak, do you think would be the rudest?
Oh, that's a great question.
Be the rudest.
The rudest animal. Just an absolute dickhead.
Definitely not cats. I know that Spork and I
Some
would have
cats would be
lovely conversations.
For sure.
Yeah, cats would be terrible.
Seagulls. Seagulls for sure would be total dickheads. For
okay,
sure.
Seagulls for Kate, cons.
Hey, sandwich. Give me a piece of chips. Hey, yeah. Especially Jersey
like an
Shore
Italian,
ones.
An Italian.
Yeah, the North Jersey seagull with a little cigarette in its mouth.
They shouldn't have took down that damn statue of Rizzo.
Yeah, yeah. A racist seagull, yeah. A racist Philly seagull, yeah. Parking the Kmart parking lot down there, yeah. That's what I would not like.
I don't know why, but I feel like I keep having a...
It's heritage, not hate. Okay. Sorry.
My southern roots up here in Jersey.
Yeah.
I don't know, like a hippopotamus. It just seems like he would be rude.
You obviously you don't follow Fiona, the baby hippo from the zoo.
I don't.
Yeah, Fiona's lovely.
You would be singing a different tune.
But Fiona could turn into a Karen when she gets older. We never know.
That's true. Mm. That's true.
It's a goose. I think that's like.
Yeah, that's the right answer.
Dicks.
Yep.
That's the right answer.
If a goose was driving like a cab, it'd be having his head out the window, cussing somebody out.
You know,
I've seen so many geese recently in the last couple of weeks walking around with their little geese ducklings or whatever.
They shit
called.
Everywhere.
They shit everywhere with no regard for human interaction whatsoever, and they hiss at you and
they'll attack you for no reason.
Yeah, come on.
Can you imagine being a bird, but like as a human? Sorry, my dickhead neighbor's doing their thing right now. Imagine that we can fly.
That was actually okay? Kate's text alert. That's what it
yeah,
sounds
like. Yeah, it was my text alert. Imagine we can fly, though. The three of us, we get up in the air right now. But here's the problem. You have to be nude. I'm not looking. Yeah. We're not looking at each other, but you're right. A bird. You're nude.
And nobody's looking at anybody's flappers.
Right. We're not looking at each other's genitals, but we're flying around.
Yeah.
And we just poop.
Yep.
Right in the sky.
It's like that one guy. You remember the dude who did?
This I think is really blowing my mind.
He jumped off like a duck, and he did.
Excuse me, Cannonball Dookie. It's a classic.
Yeah, and
Cannonball Dookie, take one.
And he just goes and he rips a line, man. Like, and it comes out looking like a full king size Snickers.
He does a cannonball off the duck, and while he's in midair, he shoots a turd out of his ass.
Yeah, straight up corn dogs it.
Another really good one is this kid on a skateboard, and he's squatting down, and his buddy's on a skateboard at the same pace right behind him, just filming his butt, and he leaves this like long string of poop on his driveway.
Well, that was my first memory of the internet, is from Rotten.com, where this fella,
great site.
Where so
this fella was on like a mountain peak. And he was bent over in like a yoga pose where you reach down and touch your feet, where it's like Savasana or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he grabbed himself by like the back of the knees, pulling himself bent over, like hunched over, where he's trying to do a toe touch and shit off this mountain in a spray that would rival the greatest fire hose of all time.
Whoa.
It was just so liquid and so gooey. And that is my first introduction to the internet. That's my first internet memory, most
amazing.
Likely.
Cannibal Dookie is one of my first memories from the internet.
Rotten.com,
so.
Pain Olympics, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to Safe Rounds Alibis. What do you got, Kate?
Okay, so imagine the three of us are nude birds. And we are just... No, I feel like I don't have anything. I feel like I'm very proud of my uniform choice. I feel like I won.
You did win. I'll give that win to you there. You won.
That's all I needed to say.
Cons?
The official Twitter account for West Point tweeted out something about graduating in 5 days. And it's weird because they've already been commissioned. So you got a bunch of second lieutenants walking around that are going to have a graduation ceremony, which I thought was odd. But then our social guy put it out there. It's like, hey, does anybody have encouraging words for the new lieutenants? And let me just say, some of you took it seriously and you were nice, but some of you were very mean. And don't think I didn't notice that.
To everybody that was mean, you can take an extra shift to Firewatch this weekend.
Yes,
have a little integrity. Shift. Come out and say that that's me. Skipper's right. I need to own up and have a little bit of Firewatch. Is that
now,
it,
Tom? I was just going to say, just in general, not just the military academies, but just in college in general, what do you think is a good gift to get for a college graduate?
Ooh.
Money, man. Just so they can blow it at the bars.
Aside from money.
Maybe buy cocaine with it.
We don't endorse drug use on this show.
Okay, just kidding. What is a good gift?
A camelback.
A camelback. A nice camelback.
Yeah.
A nice camelback. Or
nice water source.
Maybe a painting of yourself with them, and you're both nude birds, okay?
Oh.
You're up in the sky. There's poop. All right.
All right. Good answers.
Gift cards.
That's all I got.
Sound the retreat.